This is WBAA. I'm Mike Lowitzo. Purdue President Franz Cordova is wrapping up her work at the university this week. After leading the institution for 5 years, Sunday is her last day. She joins me in the studio to talk about her tenure and what's next. Dr. Cordova, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Mike.
So it's been about a year, a little over a year, since you announced you were leaving. And you noted that you still had, though, 20% of your presidency left, and it wasn't going to be a slow period for you. How has the past 12 months been?
It's been fast. I can't believe it's over. It's been a good 12 months, and by some measures, my best, because once you get to really know everybody and how to do things, then you can just move a lot faster. So I think it's been very productive.
That's what I was thinking. Getting into any job, it takes a couple years to really get your footing.
Mm-hmm.
So these past 2 years maybe have been the most productive?
Absolutely. Well, of course, we had just a year and a half or so into my presidency, we had a huge economic downturn, which caught everybody off guard. Right before that, people were buying all sorts of financial instruments that then they were trying rapidly to dispose of. So you could say that it caught people off guard. And for at least 18 months and really longer at the university where there are longer residuals, it had a major impact. And especially since we're a publicly funded institution, it was a significant event for Purdue.
How did that affect your course of action? I mean, you came in and you developed the strategic plan
right.
and ran right in the middle. Like
right.
you said, the recession hits.
Well, one of the things we decided to do was not to let go of the strategic objectives. Of course, exactly how we did them was modified, but we decided that you always want to lead with vision. And what you have to do is adjust your financial plan to achieve that vision. So we did some immediate things which we weren't anticipating doing, like looking at every part of the institution and how we could save money. So we had a lot of committees, a lot of planning to do that. Everybody got on board. It was not a very pleasant task, but an extremely necessary one. And we found a lot of ways to save. We had a lot of efficiencies that we took. And so those were more in the area of cost containment. But then we also had a lot of cost cutting. And simultaneously, we looked at different parts of the workforce and should we retain them? Should we outsource those parts and so on? And so it was an opportunity to reestablish the incredible contributions that major components of the workforce have internally, and why it was more valuable to keep on employing people in the same way that we had before, rather than privatize, outsource those operations. So I think that's a good, healthy thing to do every few years anyway, but we just had to do it right then because of the economic downturn.
Did that play into the decadal funding plan, or is that something you already had in mind?
Well, no. I'll tell you how that came about. And actually, it was separate from, but everything is a consequence of what came before. So in that sense, it was related. But it was really a much different effort. No, during the economic downturn, we assessed what looked like a structural deficit if the legislature was going in the direction that it had announced, namely with substantial cuts. So we realized we had to be ahead of that curve if we were going to maintain our strategic goals and always improve the value of Purdue education, both for alumni and especially for our current students and students to come. So the decadal funding plan actually came about after we had addressed the economic downturn, we were pulling out of it. We just realized in assessing what had been going on then, but not just during that downturn, but for the last couple of decades at least, which is that tuition costs had risen substantially more than the cost of living index by a large amount, and the state appropriations were going down consistently, and it was only a question of degree. If even in up times, they were going down slowly but steadily. So looking at those two trends, it didn't take a rocket scientist to realize that we had to do something different than what we had been doing. And what we had been doing was every 2 years, working up our budget for the state appropriations and really advocating hard for it. And this was an opportunity to think beyond a two-year horizon, to think about a decadal horizon and what was necessary to stem the trends of rising tuition and decreasing state appropriations. What could we do that would be significantly different?
Part of that was the trimester plan.
Yes.
And also the commercialization effort, discovery to delivery, I think is what
right.
it's been coined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are those seen as quote-unquote bold moves in higher education?
I think that the decadal funding plan is certainly at the forefront of what universities are doing. I think that the efforts that I've seen at least written about are about discrete efforts to, for example, like Ohio State has recently done, privatize parking. And there are a number of examples throughout the higher education establishments of individual efforts to realize more money immediately and special kinds of bond funding and so on. But ours was more a 10-year strategic plan to look at everything. I must say the effort to do so and the engagement of our faculty and our staff and our students in this was in itself a very worthwhile thing to do, to get everybody aligned to how productive that could be if you could be planning for a 10-year horizon. And so as opposed to the effort that we did during the financial downturn, where it was very unpleasant to cost cut and cost contain because that significant pain realized more or less right away, this was a very creative effort to think of how we could increase our financial capacity.
Given the economic downturn, and the news came out this week that during your 5 years, the university raised more than $1 billion for various projects, buildings, scholarships was a big part. Are you surprised by that, the generosity given the recession for 2 years plus?
Well, I think we did very, very well. And as Vice President Lisa Calvert said, there are fewer than five universities out of 4,600 nationwide that have achieved the milestone of raising $1.1 billion over 5 years. There's just a few that they know of, and that includes private universities, of course. It's really a testament to the enduring love of the institution that our alumni and friends have, and nothing more than that, that they always find a way to give back, that giving is part of what Purdue alumni and friends are always thinking about. They appreciate what it goes for the scholarships, endowed faculty, professorships, buildings, programs, it's just so many different things. And I think it's just the Boilermaker spirit to be philanthropic.
The President Scholarship, the Trustee Scholarship, I think the Marquis Scholarship. How important was that for you to raise those funds for the students?
It was enormously important because of the high cost of higher education, even though Purdue is really a bargain. And believe me, I've been now to all the welcomings of students and their parents in August when they all come onto campus, and met with students in so many different focus groups. And I really never hear a parent say that they think it's just too high and they don't know why they're here. In fact, what we get is quite different from, and mainly from people outside of the state whose students come here. And as you know, those students actually pay triple what you do in state. They say it's still a real bargain compared to some other places, and especially considering the reputation. I mean, what you're paying for is value, the quality of teaching in the classrooms, the faculty researchers that will involve students, all the programs of extracurricular activities, engagements we have for the students. So I think that Purdue's tuition is very competitive, both in-state and out-of-state. But nevertheless, all higher education institution of our category, which is research of a very high caliber, that is still a high cost compared to other things that one purchases and needs to. And so scholarships are just extremely important to make it affordable for students whose families struggle to meet that kind of cost.
What is driving the cost up?
Well, that is a very, very long case. There have been whole books written about it. It's so many factors, some of them obvious and some of them a good deal less obvious. There's very real costs to do with, say, just look at any area. Look at medical costs for the staff and faculty and the benefits that we pay there. Look at the competition for talented faculties and what it costs for it, recruiting and the startup packages that we offer and the retention packages when other institutions try to recruit them away. Look at the programs that we offer for students, the 900 student clubs and organizations and everything from band and music to academic organizations, the learning communities, the orientation programs, the athletic and the health and the fitness programs, and so on, the residential experience. And that is driven by competitive metrics. You want to attract students. You want to retain them. Yesterday, I had a conversation with members of the National Science Board as we're putting together a companion piece to our biennial Science and Engineering Indicators, which is a huge compendium of important statistics in higher education. And this piece is about the value and trends in costs in public higher education institutions. And some of the costs are directly, I would say, attributable to graduating the students. What does it take to improve our retention and graduation statistics? What kind of quality classroom experience should we have to give them and out-of-classroom experience? Because years ago, the metric was how many students can you turn away that just can't make it? That kind of proved you were a better institution if you failed 50% of your students. And that has completely changed around today. You're a better institution if you can graduate everybody. But there's a cost to that. There's a cost to investing in students. And we've put a huge focus on increasing retention. And as you know, retention's increased. It's over 90% now. And that's a new metric for Purdue.
I've got a friend in student access success area, and the amount of work and just research that goes into that and what you do to keep student A might be different from what you do to keep student B. It's exhausting.
It's almost huge. And the students all come from different backgrounds with different needs. And we have a very diverse student body. We have international students who have different needs. We have students from lower income backgrounds that have a different experience and needs. We have students with medical needs that years ago, decades ago, they may not have even chosen to go to college because they didn't know how to manage other parts of their experience. And so everything from hiring more counselors and on-campus medical facilities to just keeping healthy bodies and healthy minds is a cost. But I think we do very, very well at that. And one of the signs is, of course, retention. And another is all the students taking advantage of leadership opportunities and making their experience during their 4 or 5 years here very significant ones that position them well for the job market, where they can point to something or many things on their resume that indicate that they have been a leader, that have moved programs, policy, activities a lot farther than previously.
One of the other things you've tried to do is raise the global reputation of Purdue. And you've made trips to China, Colombia. Have you gone to Africa? And
yes.
I know pretty much all over the world.
Yes.
A while back, somebody asked me, why do that? They saw Purdue as a state school. What's the benefit, I guess?
It was interesting. Yesterday morning, I woke up to an NPR special on this generation of young people, and they actually used a new term that I hadn't had before for them called first globalists. And I thought, that's very interesting. And the idea is that students, whether they're at private or public institutions, that should be transparent, are seeking to become more and more global citizens, and they are actively looking for experiences that take them to all sorts of locations, not just one, but maybe several experiences like that, both during school and after school. And they're fearlessly going into other environments, doing research, educational experiences, cultural experiences, all different kinds of things. And with a backpack and everything that they've learned from being in college, they're making that an integral part of who they are, and they're learning from those, and that's really changing their minds about career possibilities. And so I think we are recognizing this desire in our students. I think it's just key to being a forefront university that you tap into the consciousness of what moves and motivates and inspires young people. And the more you can do that and provide them with what is already they are anxious to do and do that in the highest quality way, I think the better off they will be and the more prepared they will be for their leadership in the future, and the better positioned you will be as a university to be take your place among the highest ranks of universities. So the global experience is all part of that. And I'm proud that we've tapped into that early enough to make a real difference and to offer different kinds of experiences for our students to make their mark.
And I'm guessing also it works in reverse in that being out there, having all these ambassadors brings international students here to campus.
Oh, absolutely. I've never been at an institution that is so widely recognized abroad. Now, not every single place abroad, but more and more into different areas. We've really made inroads into Latin and South America the past few years. I think that's just great. And of course, we have a very, very strong presence in India and China, Korea, Japan, all of Asia.
Talk about Purdue as an economic engine, the research parks and the different sites in the state and trying to get these homegrown businesses that incubate here to stay here. Did that surprise you coming to the university or doing the homework before you took the job?
No, it didn't surprise me because I came out of the University of California, which is very engaged in that. All of California is a very entrepreneurial state, and students are involved with professors in startups, and there's just so many different kinds of opportunities. And when you make maps of where the new businesses are all located, just take biomedicine, biotechnology companies, they're all within a small radius of a UC campus, for example, or one of the best private institutions in California. So no, I think that I was not surprised at all, because that is the direction that the country is definitely moving, is how to take discovery to delivery. And so we coined that particular term, but rephrased an activity which has gone on at Purdue for a long time, which is that a number of professors have been very entrepreneurial. And one evidence is the technology parks that Purdue has spread along I-65 throughout the state. We opened two new ones, so we doubled the number of those technology parks in the past few years. But what we've done is try to spin up that effort and infuse it with more resources and more support from alumni and donors. And thank goodness they have really stepped up and become engaged. And we want to make sure that the faculty know that from the senior-most administration that we think this is a very important activity. It's important for Purdue's future, for its engagement. It's part of our land-grant tradition realized in a new and contemporary way, extending our land-grant mission, and that professors will be recognized and rewarded for their contributions, both in an individual sense, but also institutionally.
Did anything surprise you when you got here to take the job?
I still think what surprised me the most is what I recognized the minute I stepped onto campus was athletics is a bigger deal on a bigger stage than it was in my previous institutions, except for Penn State, of course. I was a faculty member and a department head of astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State back in the early 1990s. So that was quite a while ago. But I've held more senior positions in two UC campuses, neither of which had a football team. And so the whole Big Ten athletics and how much money and activity surrounds that and learning about that, it's a very complex business model with the network television funding and so on. And when the Big Ten presidents get together, that is what we talk about and work on, is the whole sports milieu. And we leave it to the provost to talk about the academic things of importance. And so that was, and we really, really have enjoyed it. I mean, the football on a fall day is fabulous. We've loved attending as many basketball games as possible, both women's and men's basketball games, and are huge supporters of that. But we've also attended many of the sports in addition to football and basketball here that are done very well, from volleyball to golf and tennis and baseball, softball, and so on. And my one regret is that I had a big wish that we would also accrete a men's soccer team to our fine women's soccer team. And because of the economic downturn, we were not able to realize that goal. So maybe someday.
What advice did Martin Jiski give you, if any, coming in?
Martin didn't really. We had just two meetings with him. One was at Westwood. We had a nice brunch with him and Patty and my husband Chris and I did, and that was a very social event. And then I met with Martin separately in the office of the president, and we talked about a number of things. I don't recall the details, and I'm sure he transferred important information to me at the time, but nothing that stands out in my mind right now. I mean, he did say that he would be always available for a consultation and advice. And a few times I have taken him up on that, and we've met subsequently on particular, very narrowly defined issues that I just wanted more background on, why we were at the present state that we were with that issue, and could he tell me a little bit more about the background. But he's always been there if I wish to consult with him, and we really appreciate that. And mostly, Chris and I appreciate that he and Patty have come to so many events to continually support Purdue, as have Steve and Jane Beering and Art Hansen. And one of my most vivid and fond memories is at my installation, we had a dance afterwards, and I did a fast dance with Art Hansen. And that was just a year or two before he passed away. And he was a great dancer.
Any advice to offer Mitch Daniels?
Well, I think we've already had some conversations, and we had one very long one on the eve of the announcement, and just the two of us had a nice dinner, and we talked about many things. And so I have nothing to say publicly on that score, but I would say I've always enjoyed my interactions with Governor Daniels, and I find him to be a good listener and very sharp. And he is very enthusiastic about taking on this role and making transformative change. And that's what it's all about. If you don't have that hunger in you, then you shouldn't do these kind of jobs. You have to come in here wanting to affect change. Now, that doesn't mean you won't be thrown some curveballs, and we were with the economy for sure. But then that's why you build up a great team and you all work together to address those challenges as they come along. And so I'm very enthusiastic about the future.
10 years from now, when somebody mentions Purdue President Franz Cordova, what do you hope comes to mind? What do you want your legacy to be?
Because I'm kind of a wide-ranging person that is interested in so many different things, and I think our strategic plan and my program of activities reflects that it's hard for me to just say one particular thing, because I think in every area, we've not only sustained but enhanced Purdue's wherewithal from financial. We're in a really good financial place. I think we're extremely strong on the development front, but also just in the systematics of the budget. We're in a very good place. I'm very proud that our workforce, that we kept that intact through the economic downturn when so many companies were letting people go. One of the things I fought hardest for was keeping that workforce intact, and much, much appreciate that the faculty and staff were willing to take no raises for years and froze hiring and everything in order to make that happen. So I think we got through that period, and now, of course, we are adding to our workforce because we're in a position to do so. We doubled the research budget yet again, and a doubling of a doubling is extra hard. That's an exponential curve. So I'm proud that we were involved in so many giant partnerships with other institutions that allowed Purdue to be a leader among leaders and to do that. And as we talked about, I'm very happy that our global presence is now extended to make us a very well-known, vibrant partner internationally. And we're just attracting so many applicants from all around the world. We have a huge reputation. I think if you asked individual deans and my senior officers what they would say in response to your question, Mike, is that it's the student focus that I will be remembered for. We've started so many programs which I think have a lot of traction for student success. So our goal is to have every student who comes to Purdue be successful and graduate and love Purdue and become an outstanding leader. And we're well on that path. We've increased student success metrics. We've increased the diversity of Purdue in all different aspects. We've increased the facilities for Purdue for student success. And we've really engaged students in everything from policy development to raising money to help have sustainable business plans for their new facilities that increase their own success and really engage them in the process. And I have enjoyed my moments with the students just absolutely immensely, everything from cheering on the football field and doing the shout to getting to direct the band on occasion, to marching with the band and twirling a baton, to sitting with them and really hammering out some of these policy changes. And all the student leaders that have come have just been exceptional to work with. So I think it's the legacy of new university honors program, our core curriculum, outcomes-based core curriculum that we established, the first ever for Purdue, and so many programs for student success that will be my lasting legacy.
So you're chairing the Smithsonian Institution.
What's Board of Regents.
Board of Regents, excuse me.
Yes.
What's next? What else are you going to be doing?
I am on five boards, three of them nonprofit boards, the Mayo Clinic, the Smithsonian Institution, and the National Science Board, which has a huge policy setting role for the National Science Foundation and also is advising the White House. And two corporate boards. And so those activities will keep me busy. I plan to use my sabbatical, which is the year upcoming, to write, which I love to do. I started out as a writer, as an undergraduate, graduating in English literature. And I love to write, and I've always fantasized about finishing a couple of books that I've started. So this is it. This is my opportunity, and I'd love to be able to check those off my bucket list to do. So I think those things will keep me busy for the coming year. And then who knows what's next? The idea of a sabbatical is to refresh and to see what's next. And I'm looking forward to it.
Purdue President Franz Cordova, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mike.
And good luck in the future.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to WBAA. I'm Mike Lowitzow.